Want to immerse yourself in sport and the stories of athletes from across the Pacific? Well, join me, Sam Wykes, alongside some of the most talented journalists and sports commentators from across the region for Fresh Off the Field. Each week, we'll also bring you interviews with Pacific athletes leaving their mark on the international stage and those aspiring to do the same. From cricket to netball, athletics to football, and everything in between. Listen to Fresh Off the Field on your favourite podcast app.
This is an ABC podcast.
Tā aloha ni, kamuna Māori, eka maue o mo, and good black morning. This is Pacific Beat on ABC Radio Australia. I'm your host, Aggie DeBoe, and thank you for tuning in to our show this morning. Up on the show today, President of Marshall Islands makes her first historical visit to Canberra. Political chaos in Fiji, and will that end up having Prime Minister Sitiveni Rabuka resign? To sport, though, calls for more matches more often for the PNG Muruks. All that here on Pacific Beat, where our show comes to you from the lands of the Bunurong and Wurundjeri peoples of the Kulin Nation. Again, I'm your host, Aggie DeBoe, Miss Sulung. Thank you for tuning into Pacific Beat, yours in the Pacific. We begin with the President of the Marshall Islands. Hilda Heine is in Australia on a historic state visit, the first by a Marshallese leader in more than three decades. She's held high-level talks with Prime Minister Anthony Albanese, with Foreign Minister Penny Wong describing the visit as a key step in strengthening cooperation on climate and oceans, development and regional security. So for more on this significance of this visit, we're joined by ABC's Foreign Affairs reporter in Canberra, Stephen Jedges. With that, I say good morning, Stephen. How are you doing?
Good morning, Aggie. Good to join you.
Absolutely. Thank you so much. Well, Stephen, what do we actually know about the agenda of this visit?
Not a huge amount. The government has released a little bit of information about what they've been discussing. In particular, we've had a few announcements from the Foreign Minister, Penny Wong, and the Minister for Pacific Island Affairs, Pat Conroy. In particular, the government's announced that it's signed a letter of intent with the Republic of Marshall Islands to support RMI's, what they call their Resilience and Adaption Trust Fund, which is basically a mechanism to try and get some more long-term finance for RMI to try and build up its resilience to the impacts of climate changing, including through adaption and mitigation. It's also some small-scale announcements, including the fact that Australia's going to deliver some battery energy systems for primary schools across RMI, which is going to be funded under the AIFFP. That's the infrastructure fund that Australia's set up. So a few small announcements, nothing seismic. I guess the most interesting thing about this visit is that it's happening at all, as the government's observed. We haven't actually had a visit like this since the early 90s. So it's been a long time coming.
Yeah, and as you say, it's been three decades since the Marshallese leader has actually made a state visit to Australia, right? So is it because Australia is, I don't know, not considered an important partner?
And I don't think so, in the sense that Australia has, you know, is increasingly a pretty important player across all the Pacific, and including in Micronesia and in RMI, where we've now got a much more substantial diplomatic presence than we had not that long ago. So Australia is perhaps a more meaningful player in the in RMI than it was a little while ago. That said, there's no doubt that when you look at the broad span of Australia's relationships across the Pacific historically, and it's true, I think, even to this day, our links do go deeper in Melanesia and, of course, in Polynesia than they do in Micronesia, which is, of course, typically a little bit further away, and, of course, is more deeply influenced with their relationships that they have with other partners. And in the case of RMI, the most important relationship, of course, that they have is with the United States of America as a member of the Compact States. It's got a Compact of Free Association with the U.S., which effectively means that the U.S. provides RMI with large-scale economic assistance. It allows citizens to enter and work, study and reside in the U.S., and in return, effectively, the Department of Interior and the Department of Defence have very big stakes in RMI. So compared to the US, Australia is always going to be much more of a bit player. That might explain the fact that Australia hasn't, until perhaps more recently, paid a huge amount of sort of sustained attention to RMI. That is changing, but if you're asking why haven't we had a state visit like this since around 93, that's probably the main answer.
And I mean, if you just clarify, I mean, if we're going to look at this from Canberra's view, what's the importance of this relationship with the Marshall Islands?
Look, as we've seen intense strategic competition unfold in the Pacific, Australia has come to the realization that it's got to lift its game everywhere, and that even includes the compact states, which on the face of it you'd imagine Australia would sort of initially anyway perhaps shrug at and leave to the United States. So, for example, when the current compact agreement between RMI and the US was signed into law, I think it was only last year or the year before last now, in 2024, there was a bit of a sigh of relief in Canberra, because it did look for a while like the United States might struggle to actually push some of these agreements back over the line, despite the fact that it's manifestly in its strategic interests to do so. I think Australia, is conscious that it cannot and does not want to displace the US as the main diplomatic partner for RMI. But as China has lifted its efforts, perhaps with more success in other parts of the Micronesian archipelago, to increase its influence, particularly in the Federated States of Micronesia, Australia has realised that it's really got to be present in all countries across the Pacific. And of course, there are other important elements here too. Hilda Heine, who is a very well-known and well-respected leader across the Pacific, has long been a forceful advocate for more climate action. She's got a lot of authority on this front. She's previously criticised the former coalition government in Australia over their lack of ambition over climate change, and, of course, has been pushing for global action. So as Australia contemplates this year, where it is, of course, sharing COP responsibilities with Turkey, including playing a major role in effectively organising the pre-COP meeting that's going to happen later this year in the Pacific, it will want to have those discussions with substantive and serious Pacific leaders on climate, and Hilda Heine would be near the very top of that list.
Mm. Okay, I want to switch to the fact that, the Marshall Islands is set to receive a Guardian-class patrol boat from Australia. Like, how important are these types of assets to the Pacific nations?
Look, pretty important, and that, of course, is another reason that this visit went ahead. It was timed, I suspect, around the fact that that Australia was gifting a new patrol boat to the Republic of Marshall Islands. I think this is replacing a vessel that was actually handed back around the same time that we last had a presidential visit. So, quite remarkably, I guess, in a way, this boat has been on the water in the Republic of Marshall Islands for decades. I don't know the particulars, but I imagine that boat was probably getting pretty creaky. It was a few years ago that Australia flagged that a replacement was coming for the Marshall Islands. It was around four or five days ago that it was handed over, the new boat, RMIS Gelme, Minister of the Marshall Islands over in Perth. So that was another sort of element of this broader visit. How important are these boats? Really important. Mm-hmm. As Aggie, all of these Pacific nations have vast maritime zones. That's no exception from Republic of Marshall Islands. They simply don't have the resources to really patrol them in any substantive or meaningful way. It's simply beyond their capabilities. But what these boats do is that they do give nations like RMI a level of capability to do some of those things. So in other words, boats like this are pretty indispensable to countries across the Pacific who, very understandably, want to try and keep an eye on their areas, and they want to keep an eye on things like illegal fishing. Which, as we know, is pretty rampant throughout parts of the Pacific. That deprives Pacific nations of the money and the resources that they very badly need. So, it's important.
Yeah. I mean, Stephen, when we look at the overall picture, because, you know, how much of this visit is shaped by broader strategic competition in the Pacific, again, geopolitically looking, particularly with China in the picture?
Yeah, I think perhaps this one slightly less so than others, because not only, of course, is the Republic of Marshall Islands a compact state. In other words, it has very deep links, as we're discussing, with the United States. It's also one of the three Pacific nations that still recognizes Taiwan. Rather than the PRC. So in that sense, unlike in, for example, the Federated States of Micronesia, China doesn't have a formal diplomatic foothold in any way. And so it's not a player, at least directly, in RMI. But, of course, we've seen, Pacific nations of the last few years flip. Taiwan remains anxious about the prospect of its remaining Pacific allies being coaxed away. That doesn't seem, as best as I can tell, to be on the table for RMI. But that broader picture of intense strategic competition undoubtedly informs visits like this. And even with China, largely out of the picture, Australia's got its own reasons to deepen its diplomatic equities across the Pacific, including in compact states that have a close relationship with Taiwan, like the Republic of Marshall Islands.
Mm. Well, Stephen, look, as always, we really appreciate you keeping us across the happenings there in the capital. But thank you so much for joining us this morning.
No problem. Thanks, Aggie.
That is our ABC Foreign Affairs reporter, Stephen Gidgets, here on Pacific Beat.
For centuries, Pacific Islanders have been sharing stories that connect us across the region. Stories from the Pacific is a weekly program that continues that tradition, bringing you deep and personal stories from a diverse range of people. Athletes, farmers, artists, teachers, activists, entrepreneurs, all united by their Pacific heritage and incredible journeys. Join us for Stories from the Pacific, Wednesdays at 9 a.m. PNG time on ABC Radio Australia or where you get your podcasts.
Kia ora wa, and thank you for tuning into Pacific Beat. I'm your host, Aggie DeBoll. At its peak, Panguna on Bougainville was one of the world's biggest copper mines. It also became the spark for a decade-long civil war that killed thousands. Now, more than 30 years later, Panguna is being pushed as the economic engine for Bougainville's independence ambitions, with reports suggesting that President Ismail Toroma wants to see the mine reopened in June. And already, he has sidelined a Chinese investor in favour of an Indian firm. Oliver Nobendal is the project director for the Australian PNG Network at the Lowy Institute and says there are plenty of questions on the ground over the future of Panguna.
It's not unexpected that the president is pushing for the mine to be reopened, with 2027 set as sort of the hard deadline that the Bougainville government is putting for independence. It's clear that there needs to be a massive economic injection. I think what is surprising to a lot of people is how quickly the anticipation is for the mine to open by June. It's no mystery that Panguna mine right now, while it is claimed to be a bit of a brownfield mine, the startup cost to restart what the Panguna mine was, build back all the infrastructure, is going to be the cost of really starting a new mining operation. So whether or not that can be done in 6 months is quite aspirational as well. But once again, it is unsurprising that that's where the priority of the government is right now.
And why is reopening the mine this year so important to the Bougainville government?
I think, like we said, the 2027 deadline for independence is set by the Bougainville government. So the mine has to start in the lead up, start to sort of bring in the revenue in the lead up to 2027. Running some numbers for this before, I think in 2024, and really historically, the Bougainville government, after the crisis, has struggled to generate internal revenue and has relied on a lot of revenue that's coming externally from donor funding, but primarily the biggest source of revenue is from the national government, the PNG national government, in the form of grants. So that number has actually been decreased. Back in 2024, it was about, I think, 6.6% of the ABG budget was made internally. And looking at the numbers for the 2026 budget, that number has decreased to, I think, 5.3%. But I think, like, as a nominal value, the internal revenue generated is dropping by about $5 million In the past 2 years. So that's not a good sign. And I think why it's being put on so much there's so much emphasis being put on the mine is that although it's going to take a long time to start up again, it should deliver sort of the revenue the Bagamoyo government wants.
And so what do you think would be the feeling on the ground about plans to reopen the mine? Is there support for it?
Yeah, so that seems to be the biggest question a lot of people have now. For a lot of people, it's taken them by surprise at how this process has come about. You know, for Bougainville Copper Limited had started the selection process last year, and they seem to have a preferred mining operator to partner with, which is a Chinese company, CMOC. And then you have Lloyds Metals, which is the Indian company, which is preferred by the Bougainville government. Now, the views on the ground is that this seems to have happened very quickly. There are concerns around sort of how transparent the selection process was and what are the value propositions that each company can give to the Bougainville people. Now, there are a lot of people who do want the mine to open back up again, but then there are also concerns around how the engagement is going for landowners, where there is consensus amongst everyone that the mine can reopen. And that seems to be the biggest question mark facing a lot of people on the ground. What does it mean for the environmental challenges? What happens with benefit sharing? So there's a lot of questions that are unanswered, which could gain a lot of confidence from Bougainvillians living in Bougainville. But for now, there seems to be sort of questions that remain to be answered.
The Bougainville government is the main shareholder in Panguna. Does that mean that all the different parties have to wait and seek approval from the government?
This is more of a question of how much involvement should the main shareholders have in the running of the business. Now, understandably, the BCL board has a lot of commercial acumen that's on the board, and they can make these sort of commercial decisions. But being the major shareholder, it does have a majority say in what is being run. But it also becomes a little bit tricky now because the ABG is also the biggest shareholder in BCL, but it's also the regulator of the mining industry as a whole in Bougainville. And it also raises questions about conflict of interest and how that will be run. So that has to be something as well that's managed carefully so that it does not deter other investments coming into Bougainville as well.
And talking about the bid process and different companies or countries of, you know, where these companies are going to be coming from, why is President Toroama keen for an Indian company to take up the project?
Well, I think that's the question that a lot of people are asking now. What exactly, and this goes back to sort of the question I asked earlier, what is the value proposition or what was the sort of decision-making calculus that President Toroama and the ABG had done to select this Indian company? The Indian company, from my understanding, has limited mining experience, similar to what is needed in Bougainville. There was a different preference from what was being provided in the news reports, saying that the BCL, the actual company, preferred for the Chinese company as well. So I think there has to be a lot of these questions asked, and if there is a clear answer to it, then the Bougainville government needs to come out and give that answer. Otherwise, people will be left to the imagination as to what exactly it is that, you know, that has led to this Indian company getting the preference for it. India traditionally is not usually involved in these sort of areas in the Pacific. A lot of these development projects are either done by Western companies coming into not just in PNG or Bougainville, but across the Pacific. And if not, China has been the other player as well. So this is maybe the turn of a new dynamic in the Pacific, or there would be a specific sort of value that the public just is not privy to at the moment.
And do we know how much minerals and gold reserves are in Panguna?
Oh, look, I couldn't give you a number. I have read it, but it never sticks in my head. So unfortunately, I can't. I think from what I have heard, that it's in the ballpark of around 28 billion kina.
And finally, Oliver, we know what the government wants, with President Toroama clear on his position, but do we know what communities want?
Yeah, look, that's an excellent question. And I think that is not clear yet. And then I'll say two things on this point here. While there would have been an overwhelming vote for independence to show that this is what the majority of Bougainvillians want, I think it also has to... These are the situations now where we see that, you know, independence or sovereignty is not something that you can just elect to have. It requires work every day, and that means coming in and asking these questions and holding your government to account for good governance practices. So this is something as well, I think, that needs to be sort of slowed down and considered carefully. While, you know, the Panguna mine is going to be a massive injection economically into Bougainville, we also have to be aware of the history where, while the mine is located located in central Bougainville when the crisis had occurred as sort of a spin-off from frustrations with the mine, or everyone in Bougainville was affected by the 10 years of the civil war that was had. So it's not only a decision that can't be made by the Bougainville government, it's not one that can be made alone by landowners, but it has to require consultation and consensus, I think, from the whole of Bougainville.
And that there is Oliver Nobendale, Project Director for the Australia PNG Network at the Lowy Institute, speaking there to ABC's Godwin Eke. Now, Fiji has been thrown into fresh political uncertainty following this week's landmark ruling by the Suva High Court. The court found Prime Minister Sitiveni Rabuka acted unlawfully when he advised the President to dismiss Fiji's anti-corruption commissioner. The decision to do so was based on the recommendations of a commission of inquiry into the appointment of Barbara Malimali as head of the Fiji Independent Commission Against Corruption. Prime Minister Rabuka has since lodged an appeal, saying he'll step down if that appeal is unsuccessful. To help us understand what this means for Fiji's political stability and institutions, we're joined by Romy Teshkant, a PhD candidate at the Australian National University's Department of Pacific Affairs. With that, I say, Bula Romy Tesh, and welcome to Pacific Beat. Yeah, thank you for joining us, Ramatish. What is your reaction on hearing the outcome of this ruling?
I think it's a very important ruling. The court has clarified something quite fundamental, that removal of an independent institution's commissioner is meant to be insulated from direct executive control. And it has basically drawn clear guidelines through the Constitution and the relevant laws that, you know, these independent appointments to these independent bodies are not merely based on prime ministerial advice, but rather, you know, there are guardrails and institutions to to protect the independence. And I think politically, what is striking is that this ruling also has political implications, is that, you know, the court did not just correct a technical error, but rather it drew a clear constitutional boundary around executive power when it comes to an important institution like an anti-corruption agency. And that has serious implications in Fiji, I think, for how integrity bodies are supposed to function.
Yeah, and that leads me to my next question. Like, what impact do you think this ruling will have on Fiji politics itself?
It's hard to tell for now, but I think what it has done is this is a very high-stakes decision as well, because on one level, you know, it's signaling that there is going to be, there is accountability and processes. But the way the Prime Minister, it has also curtailed, executive power, which has been concentrated within the 2013 Constitution. As we all know, that the Constitution was drafted and implemented by a military regime back in 2012. And since then, the government has acted as if, you know, the executive has quite a lot of power, and the constitution did confer quite a lot of power to the executive. But I think what this court decision is showing is that while there are flaws to the constitution, there are also some mechanisms to protect independence of institutions. And I think the real test is going to be how the government responds to this decision and what steps it takes to ensure that it follows the decision of the court.
Hi, Romy Tesh. I'm Fina Fanua here. Just taking over from Agi. So essentially, the PM took action because of the findings of the Commission of Inquiry into Mali's appointment. Was the commission wrong?
I wouldn't be able to speculate on whether the commission was wrong or not, but there are questions around how the commission was set up and how the chair of the commission was selected. And I think it's important to note as well is that the director for public prosecutions, hired a King's Counsel to look at the recommendations of the Commission of Inquiry and found that, you know, the Director of Public Prosecutions does not have, or the report does not have sufficient evidence to actually take the investigate and prosecute, the recommendations of the commission. So there are questions around that as well that needs to be grappled with in terms of, you know, the recommendations of the Commission of Inquiry as well.
And Prime Minister Rambuka says he'll resign if his appeal fails. What's your reaction to this?
It's an interesting statement from Prime Minister. I mean, I think if you take it one way, at one level, he's saying that he's prepared to take responsibility for the advice he personally gave. But I think we need to be careful here as well, is that, you know, this statement from Prime Minister Rambuka that he will resign, it risks personalizing what is fundamentally an institutional and a constitutional issue. So that this, the way I see it is that this case should not be about one individual's political survival, but rather, you know, it should be about restoring confidence in the institutions, independent institutions, such as an anti-corruption agency. So I think the real test around the rhetoric around Prime Minister's resignation, it's not just that. It's whether, you know, how the government takes this forward. Does it respect the courts, and does it strengthen institutional safeguards around independent institutions going forward?
Hmm. And Fiji has elections coming up. Do you think this will affect Rambuka's political future? Do you think this is going to have an impact on his reputation?
Yeah, it's happening at a very interesting time as well. Yeah, correct, that elections are due later, second half of this year. It's hard to tell whether, it will affect Rambuka's personal popularity or, you know, voter perception of Rambuka. I mean, just yesterday, the Minister for Climate Change and Environment came out speaking on behalf of Cabinet and the party, saying that they stand united behind the Prime Minister. And the elections will be interesting in the sense that it's going to be, Fiji First, the former Fiji First party is no longer there. So it's an open field and it's hard to actually tell what's going to happen in the elections. But I don't see it affecting Rambuka's popularity that much, but it does dent his reputation to a certain extent.
And how are the public reacting to this latest drama from Fiji politics? You said before it does dent his popularity a bit, but you're saying that he's still the popular leader, still the front runner in the upcoming elections.
This issue needs to be taken in sort of context with whatever what has happened over the last 4 years as well. And I think the way in which decisions are made, and there's a certain aspect of, you know, the constitution in itself gives the executive so much power in Fiji. There have been other decisions that Rambuka has made that has, you know, been questionable. Reshuffles of governments at the last minute, ministerial portfolios. And I think the bigger issue here is that after the 2022 elections, we were promised a different type of, different way of governing that would be democratic, that would be transparent. And what is this highlighting, this issue highlights, is that, you know, Fiji has a long way to go to actually restore trust and confidence in a public's trust and confidence in our political, both elected institutions, but also independent institutions. And I think, as I mentioned earlier, you know, the real test would be how the government, you know, responds to this, and how does the government actually ensure that, you know, it respects the decision of the court, but also sort of builds confidence of the people and trust in the institutions and elected representatives as well. The way people are responding, it's pretty early for now. I think the Prime Minister has indicated that he will possibly launch an appeal against this decision. But I feel, you know, the court case needs to be read by lawyers, but also by academics and civil society as well, to see what actually the court said once the decision is publicly released. And steps should be taken from there rather than jumping, you know, based on the initial sort of the ruling and not sitting down with what actually the court has mentioned.
Binakabaka level, Romy Tesh Kant. I really appreciate this interview. Very insightful.
Well, Morena, if you just tuned in, welcome back. And yes, I am back in the hot seat. Thank you for choosing Pacific Beat as your trusted source of news and views for the region. I'm your host, Aggie DeBoer, and there's a quick recap of what's been on the show so far. We spoke about President of Marshall Islands, who has actually made her first historical visit to Canberra. Also, political chaos in Fiji. Questions have risen whether the Prime Minister, Sitiveni Rambuka, will resign. And still plenty of questions over the future of Panguna Mines. Still to come, though, former PNG military commander cautions current government on the ever-growing illegal use of high-powered weapons to fuel violence across PNG's highlands, and to support these calls for more matches, more often, for the PNG Muruks. All of that here on Pacific Beat, but right now, it's time for your news wrap. And welcome back to Pacific Beat. I'm in the studio with our producer, Finau Funua, who's going to bring us our latest headlines from around the region. With that, I say, Fefe, how are you doing?
Agi, I'm fine, thank you.
And look, I honestly have to address the fact that you saved me just in the last few moments of taking over. A bit of an emergency, but hey, we're back and we're going to head around the region now. Starting with Germany, this is a really interesting one. They recognise Niue as a sovereign state by formalising diplomatic relations. Yeah, tell us more, Finau.
Yes, that's correct. Germany has formally established diplomatic relations with Niue. Germany's Foreign Minister, Dr. Johann David Weidfu, signed a declaration agreement with Niue's Prime Minister, Dalton Tungalangi, in Auckland this week. The German High Commissioner says it's part of Germany's wider policy to strengthen relations with Pacific Island countries, particularly members of the Pacific Islands Forum. Tungalangi says the establishment of diplomatic relations with Germany is an important moment for Niue because it strengthens its place in the international community. Tungalangi has said consistently in the past that his government is not, not seeking to break its status as a dependency of New Zealand. But no doubt, this latest development raises eyebrows given it's an independent foreign policy decision by Niue. An interesting development, indeed.
Yeah, absolutely. I'm sure we'll keep our eyes and ears on that story. Tribal fights in the PNG Highland, they've actually forced the stoppage of a New Zealand multi-million dollar power project. Let us know what's happening here.
Yes, according to Radio New Zealand, New Zealand has stopped its rural electrification project in Tasker Valley, that's in the highlands of Papua New Guinea. And this follows ongoing tribal conflicts in Enga. Foreign Affairs Minister Justin Chachenko says the project was worth over 5.6 million Australian dollars, according to a spokesperson for New Zealand's Foreign Ministry. Contractors stopped work at the site. It's in Wapanamamendas, Tasak Valley. Apologies if I pronounced that wrong. But Chachenko said he met with the New Zealand High Commissioner to explain the decision. And it's part of combined efforts with the US and Japan to help 70% of PNG homes get connected by 2030. Former PNG Prime Minister Peter O'Neill agreed on the PNG Electrification Partnership with leaders from Australia, New Zealand, Japan following the APAC Leaders Summit in 2018. But that project is on hold because of tribal violence.
Of course, of course. Okay, let's head to, this warms my heart, Tonga's flag bearing sensation. Peter Telford IV will carry an Olympic flag at this year's Winter Games. Just want to know, what sport did he actually qualify to get into the Winter Games?
None.
Besides wearing no shirt.
he did not qualify to get into the Winter Games. He's a representative of the Pacific. So he's carrying a flag. He's carrying an Olympic flag on behalf of the Pacific. It's a kind of representation of the different areas of the world. But the Tongan athlete, he was named as an Olympic flag bearer this week. The Olympic, the Winter Games takes place in Milano Cortina. And that's in Italy, sorry. But the flag bearing will be carried at two symbolic locations of the games, where the opening ceremony will take place, in Milan's San Siro Olympic Stadium, accompanied by eight flag bearers, and in Cortina with two flag bearers. He's also the UNICEF Pacific Ambassador. He advocates for children's rights, education and health, and has done a lot of humanitarian work in disaster relief, youth employment and so forth. And he resides in Hapai, the islands north of Tonga.
Hapai, homeland. Look, I'm not going to be against the fact that, you know, he's just going to wear some traditional dress and no shirt and oiled up.
And very cold.
But what a great sight to see. So thank you very much for that. Finau, that is your headlines from across the region, brought to you by our producer, Finau Funua, here on Pacific Beat.
Want to catch up or listen again to your favourite ABC Radio Australia programs anytime, anywhere? From Pacific Beat to Stories from the Pacific, Nijin Footy to Culture Compass. You can listen to your top shows on your favourite podcast app on the go and for free. Just search for your favourite ABC Radio Australia program in your podcast app and press play. ABC Radio Australia, bringing you more ways to listen.
Manuia Letaia, welcome back to Pacific Beat. Now, 25 years after writing about the spread of illegal guns in Papua New Guinea, former Defence Force Commander Jerry Singarok says little has changed. Singarok is now urging the government to step in and confront what he calls a growing national security threat. He says criminals are using illegal high-powered weapons to fuel violence across PNG's highlands. Speaking to local journalists, Singarok said the government must take ownership of the problem and act.
These people are operating in Wapanamanda, going up to Kompiam, and bringing the arsenal down to Kandep, to Nipa, slaughtering people, and that's what I mean about national security. Whilst we can do roadblocks along the highway, but what about 2 kilometers inland, like Honorable Wairapa said, General, you just have to stop along the National Highway, Highlands Highway, walk 5 kilometers each way, either way, and you'll see where PNG is today, where we are today. There's no services, people are afraid of guns, drugs. So your question is so relevant. At least for the first time, we have a government that is concerned. But what we're trying to advocate here as advisors in our respective role as civil society is that the government needs to just make, it just have to step up other than being tough. We'll shoot you. Death penalty. But you cannot shoot somebody without changing the legislation. Because people have a right. This is democracy. So therefore, we're urging this government, and after 2027, for us to change certain legislations. And you and me cannot do it. The government will do it on the floor of parliament. That basically is a deterrent, that the government has full authority over society. And people say, no, we just put up put down guns. So let's exchange guns for projects. Let's make community safe. And it's all contained in the 2005 report. That's why we're urging this government to take 2005 report and start to see where it can start implementing. Because the ball is in the government's court, not in civil society's court. National security is the responsibility of government, not civil society. Once they take responsibility, then we will collaborate to make Papua New Guinea safe.
And that there is former PNG military commander Jerry Singerok speaking there. Sport and staying with PNG, the men's national AFL team from Papua New Guinea are the reigning Pacific Cup holders. But there is another team from PNG that has just been crowned Asian Club Champions for the fifth time. After they were strangely excluded from the Asian Championship, which they first won in 2019 and then three times in a row after COVID between 2022 and 2024, the Muruks were invited to take on the Dragons in Hong Kong in a winner-takes-all encounter. And despite some unfavourable cold and wet conditions, the Muruks did it in style, defeating the Dragons by 59 points. But although the Muruks have another trophy in their cabinet, coach Patrick Lloyd says what they really want is more matches, more often, and not just one-offs.
We've won four Div 1s in the Asian Championships. This is the Asian Champs Cup. So it's a new concept that was brought to us to play the winner of the Asian Championships. It went really successful and we're looking for future games.
Isn't the downside, though, of that arrangement that you played in previous Asian Championships and would have played, I presume, a number of games, whereas in this instance, you're only playing one game and you're having to really come off a standing start?
Yeah, correct. Disappointing finding out that we wouldn't be able to play in the Championships. I believe that's due to some policies in the AFL that's decided that outcome for us. We believe there could be another opportunity, possibly down the line, to re-enter. It was really positive speaking to the guys from Hong Kong. They want us back in the competition, so we just have to work through that over this upcoming period to try and get something locked away.
And for those who are not too familiar with the AFL scene in Papua New Guinea, spell out for me the connection between the Muruks and the national team, the Mosquitoes. How does that work?
Basically, the Mosquitoes are the Pacific side. They play in the Pacific. We do have some Aussie players that play with us. However, we really want really build a connection between the two sides as one. But it's also given an opportunity to other people that are going to miss out on the Mosquitoes. They usually play every 3 years. We're trying to get a competition that goes each year. This year, we saw about 70 players turn up for training. There's a massive call, I believe, for more to be done in this space to give these young Papua New Guineans a chance to get out of country and go abroad. They've got amazing talent, which should be showcased.
So when would you expect the Muruks to next play a game of any sort?
We're really hoping to get a game in October. There's a couple of other things. Also, Hong Kong are looking at doing another Champions thing. However, this transition period at the moment is really up in the air. It's a bit of a work in progress in saying that we'll be trying really hard with AFL Australia, AFL PNG to try and work something out, and also AFL Asia.
What are the prospects then, perhaps, of having some sort of league competition within PNG, or if not, perhaps with one or two other of the Pacific countries that have an AFL presence?
That's something for AFL PNG development to step in there to see that happening. From us, from our point of view, we're basically a self-funded club, so we rely heavily on sponsorship for local companies here in PNG to get anywhere to begin with. That comes down to training facilities, team merch, and flights to get out. It's definitely a work in progress, trying to get to the next step. I am confident that we'll get something underway in the next couple of months. That's just speaking with some other countries. That's including Vietnam and Hong Kong.
But at the moment, the Muruks, they're essentially a club in isolation.
Correct, 100%. We're a club that could be something. We don't really fall in line with the Pacific side. However, we're trying to be a club that can go elsewhere and not be limited to just Pacific. That would be the future for the Muruks, definitely.
And the fact that you can do what you have done over the last 4 or 5 years, five Asian championships in a row, whichever way you've had to contest for that championship, you've succeeded. I mean, it's a pretty remarkable effort by a team which only plays every now and again.
Put it down to some good management. I've got advice with Alex, who's the club president, and also Anthony, who's the vice president. They really put the drive behind what we do. They work endlessly in the background on the sponsorship side to make this work. So PNG has amazing talent too. This year, we could only take X amount of players, where I believe we've easily fielded two sides. And there's a lot of people that missed out this year.
And that's Patrick Lloyd, coach of the PNG Muruks, the undisputed AFL Champions of Asia, who was talking to Richard Ewart. And incidentally, as well as coaching, Patrick also played in Hong Kong, having been persuaded to come out of international retirement. Now, Papua New Guinea athletics champion and national 60-metre sprint record holder Pius Wissel is competing at the Victorian Track and Field Championships in Melbourne. Wissel says he's targeting a strong season in 2026 with his sights set on several major international events, including the Oceania Championships, the World Indoor Championships and the Commonwealth Games. The PNG sprinter told the ABC's Godwin Eke he's feeling fit and confident ahead of his first competition of the year.
2026, it's a big, there's not a lot of competition, but there's some few like Commonwealth Games and the Oceania Championships and the World 60-meter indoors. That's the only three big competition that I'm moving for and I'm working towards that.
And how is training going for you so far as you prepare yourself for these three events that are coming up?
Training is, I'm going well with my coach and then I'm just aiming for the three big events. So now the first one is the 60 meters. So that's why like now I've been going back to, I've been going for Christmas holiday and then came back and then we went on the speed and just to get the time on board for the world indoor 60 meters. So that's what we're hoping for. And then the next one we're looking for the Oceania Championship, Oceania Championship, and then the Commonwealth Games, and then some other meets in between all those events. So training has been good, and we're aiming for the specific event that's coming up.
And you've had some success, you know, in the past, especially when it comes to training, where you also, you know, broke your personal best records late last year with your coach, who was also very happy, as well as Tony Green. What are you hoping to work on this time? And is there a time frame that you're looking at maybe to get in the 60 meters race that's coming up this weekend in Melbourne?
I'm ready for that, so I'm prepared for that. So the camera I've been done, and then like I ran the first time, but the win is just annoying, and then it's a bit winner's. It's a little bit, but it's anyway, that's a good indication that when now I can capable of running faster. So now I'm ready. So yeah, getting more way better and better, and one step ahead. So
how has it been training with your coach, and what's he hoping to get out of this when both of you travel for this weekend's competition in Melbourne?
Oh, he was so excited. Coach really so excited. That's why like we're working a little things which I have to work on it. He knew it, and then he just from there, and then we have to work on this, and then like he's so excited. So we both of us happy, so we'll go there and then we'll play our part. I'll do my best, and then coach also happy for that. So we're so happy and excited for that.
And you mentioned earlier that you've got, you know, other big international events. How are you going to prepare for that following this weekend's competition?
Me and coach will work on that a bit later, but just for now, is the World Indoor is coming close. So we're very hard to get our time. We train hard, and then whatever weakness in my training sport, we just figure out and then we fix it, and then just want to execute and just qualify and then go to that World Indoors. And then after that, we focus on the Commonwealth game or the Oceania Champs. What am I going to do, like speed endurance and some other stuff. So it's race by race, we target each competition and get prepared.
And that's PNG Athletics champion Pius Wissel talking to reporter Godwin Eke. That brings us to the end of Pacific Beat. Remember, we're back at the same time tomorrow, 6 a.m. PNG time, but you can hear us this afternoon at 5 p.m. PNG time. As always, stay tuned to ABC Radio Australia because your news is next. And coming up after that, it is Nija Daily with Michael and Jacob. Until next time, atoa whaato. You've been tuning in to Pacific Beat, yours in the Pacific.